This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and each week on this program, I bring to the audience what I feel is really cutting-edge technology to evolve us as true human beings. We are coming into what I feel is a flowering of our potential, and each week I talk to people who are furthering our individual and collective evolution. So this week I have someone who's really, I think, devoted his life and his career and his intelligence to this ongoing inner and outer development. His name is Salahin. He has a website called Ad Humanitas, and he works really, I feel, in bringing out a deeper humanity in all of us through a technology that's embedded in the body. Salahin, are you there?
I'm here, Alan. Yes, hi.
Is that a fair introduction? How would you describe what it is that you do?
I think when people ask me if I've got a 60-second elevator talk, I never really have.
No. Well, then let's just start with talking about what you do, which is an ontological understanding and development within the human body.
Yes. Well, let's take me back into about 35 years ago. I started as an osteopath and acupuncturist in England and in London. And what I started to sort of recognize as a therapist was that there were many people who didn't really get better, even though I was jolly good at what I did. And I started to recognize that as an osteopath, I was looking at a physical body, but I was never really looking at who they really were. So I had this sort of missing gap in these humans that would turn up in my practice. And I started to recognize that there were areas that we might call an ontological sort of awareness that I was not really ever looking at. And it was, who are these people coming in with these pains and aches and problems with their bodies? And what were the sort of missing elements in them
Wait just 1 second so I follow you. I mean, can you just define, I think ontological means a reality-based, but when you say, who are they, what level of depth are you looking for in that?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think in those days I knew anything about levels of depth, but what I did realize was that they were people who weren't really in contact with themselves, and others were not really very alive, and others weren't very reflective. And I started to recognize that these three elements that I just named, which is to be in contact with self, to be alive, and to be reflective, actually represented an icon which we use in medicine called the caduceus. The caduceus is a symbol of medicine which has a straight line in the middle, a staff. It has usually a single or a pair of snakes running up it and a pair of wings on the top. And it illustrates sort of well-being in its sort of primary process. But if we take those three elements, it's made up of a straight line which we then inferred the idea of integrity. It's made up of a snake, which represents the idea of flexibility or coming alive, and it has a pair of wings, which represents light or information or knowledge or self-knowledge. And we recognize that people who came in to see me were displaying these three elements in that those three elements weren't really present inside themselves, so they weren't in contact, they weren't alive, or they weren't reflective about why they were sick. And that was
But that's true of most people on the planet, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, you're completely correct. But you know, it was news to me as an osteopath who had been given that sort of symbol as a sort of badge of here you are, you're an osteopath now. This is what your medicine really infers. I had no idea what that symbol meant, and then started to see that actually the symbol represented an emergence of health, the idea that we come out of our roots. So this sort of ontological idea, coming out of where we are, our DNA, our history, our constitution, our family backgrounds, our Englishness, Scottishness, Americanness, if you like. Mm-hmm. We emerge mm-hmm. out of that, and we slowly start to come alive. We start to be sort of fully able to move through life and be active and self-motivated, and then we start to have a cognitive understanding of who we are. Well, to do all of those things, you need those three elements. You need to be in contact with yourself, you need to be alive in all the parts, and you need to be self-reflective. There are other elements to that as well, but that was the sort of first thing that I recognized in those people who were sick, that they were missing one or more of those three primary elements.
So then you developed what you felt was a technology that would then bring about those one of those three or all of those three back into the person.
Yes, yes, I did. I was very fortunate in that I had a very good teacher from Oregon, which is actually where we live at the moment. And this man was Alan Beardall. He was a chiropractor. He came over to England, and he taught us a system of clinical kinesiology, which was using muscle testing and what he called mudras, and we often call hand modes, which are a hand language, a sign language. Mm-hmm. And what we used was this system of kinesiology, which is a feedback system, and this language-based gesture language. And it enabled us to sort of talk to our patients, to dialogue with our patients. Mm-hmm. And so over the year... Mm-hmm.
No, I just want to say it's true. I've had some of this done, and when you put your hands in a certain position, it seems like a different interior state of consciousness seems to be achieved. I don't know quite know how that works. I mean, how would you explain how that works?
That's a very good question. Well, there are a number of different ways of looking at it. First of all higher animals, which includes us, actually, have what we might call a proto-language. In other words, we use gestures to illustrate our state. You know, if we were monkeys, we actually higher monkeys, chimpanzees, in fact, sign in the wild. So we develop a sign language. Now, if you look at people who are mute, in other words, they're not able to talk, they're using their hands, they're using their gestures, they're using their postures, everything other than their verbal dexterity. And so they're using their bodies constantly to promote and to give information. And what we started to recognize was that the hands were sort of like a mini holograph of what's going on inside the body. So what we understand is that when you put into your hands a mudra or hand mode, that what you're doing is you're, in a way, sort of putting a micro, a pictorial representation of what's going on in your somatosensory cortex. In other words, the part of your brain that's recording your whole postural, emotional, sort of vegetative posture at that moment as you hold that thought. So a gesture demonstrates a thought, an idea, a moment in time, a exclamation, et cetera,
Well, they're sort of like neural pathways seem to be reconnected in a different...
Absolutely.
And in acupuncture, they say that the limbs are sort of the control panel. I've studied acupuncture. They say they're the control panels in a way. They're like the buttons you press for the internal organs to be activated. So there is this, in some parts of Chinese medicine, a relationship between the extremities and the interior.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. And the same with this, yes.
Yeah, and there are thousands of different... Who was the guy who first developed this? What was his name?
Well, he was a man called Alan Beardall. He's unfortunately... He died in 1986.
Beardall. And there are thousands of different hand positions, right?
Yes. Well, he sort of developed and received about probably 600. I've developed about... and received about 1,800 of them. So yes,
wow.
There's an awful lot. It is really like a language, and it enables us to have a dialogue with another human being, which is a most privileged, extraordinary process, because it allows the person to give us information that is really only privy to them, but from their deep, deep subconscious, which is quite extraordinary.
Well, that's one question I did want to ask, because I have gone through a few sessions with this sort of ontological kinesiology, and it's like, is that what you call it, or inner dialogue, I think you're calling
it,
right?
Well, inner dialogue is really the sort of umbrella language that we're using, but really it's an ontological approach to well-being, to education, to social interaction, to relationships, etc. We can, in other words, use this modeling for really anything that we want to do. So it's
but
a very
having
powerful.
You, mm-hmm. No, go, sorry. It's a very powerful tool, right?
Very powerful tool, yeah.
But how did you ever figure out that this, putting my fingers, my two front four fingers together and my thumb over, and actually meant something or affected a mental state and a physiological state?
That was probably the most difficult part, and I think, you know, there are times when I still put question marks into that. Really what it was that this was a clinical situation. I was in practice in London, and right at the beginning, the sort of mudras that sort of I received, i.e. they came into me as I surrendered to God, that they came into my hands, they were given to me in situ whilst I was working with patients. So the field of the patient was sort of, if you like, in the room, and so when these mudras came in, they weren't abstract, they were sort of absolutely associated with this person lying in front of me on the table. So as I muscle tested using this new received mode, my cognitive understanding would be, okay, what am I, you know, what have I just been talking about, what have we been, just been doing, what's the, you know, what's his body displaying, where are we? And really, it used to take me probably half an hour, 40 minutes to sort of get the aha and go, oh, gosh, that's what it's doing. And muscle testing allowed us to be very clear about we are on the right direction or that we are, you know, really off direction. So we managed to name these modes, and over the time we've seen that these modes had a certainty, had a reality associated with them, that when we use them in different cultures, that the same understanding is there. So it seems to be a universal language, which is really marvelous.
So then getting back to where you, what you first noticed, how to get the person connected, alive, and reflected, how did to continue that development?
Well, what really happened was as we started to recognize that these three elements of the caduceus were the key, we realized that actually these, shall we say, iconic models were not present inside the human being. They were abstract. They were sort of ideas. And so what we started to do was to say, you know, how do we bring into these people's lives the idea of being integrous, being upright, being connected, being grounded, being on a straight path, being connected to heaven and to earth? That's all the sort of nuance of integrity. How do we talk about the snake or the feminine or flexibility or transformation or being able to envelop or expand or widen one's consciousness? And so we started to develop models of personal development that enabled us to give people experiential tastes of these qualities that often were outside of them, but actually by giving them inner experiences, they, in a way, gave themselves space and permission for these qualities to begin slowly, slowly to grow within themselves.
But give me an example of these models that allow these things to grow within themselves.
Okay. Well, there are two ways of explaining it. One is that we've taken, or I have taken, this ontological process from many different sources. I've been a Muslim for 35 years, I think, now. And so I have a background of sort of a mystical Islam. I'm not a Sufi, but I sort of have been involved in all of that sort of arena. And they have a model which comes out of Kabbalistic theory, comes out of Platonic thought, which is called emanation, the idea that we emerge out of, if you like, the material, the clay, and come alive. So we are beings that emerge out of, if you like, a base and move into a living, ordered, organized, and dynamic human being. So as I started to sort of recognize this intellectually, in my work, I started to see that we could emulate that by, in fact, using muscle testing, this was a long time ago, using muscle testing as a feedback tool, but taking people in different situations and creating a scenario where they could see their own emergence or feel their own emergence.
You mean the emergence as a spirit, as a living form out of the clay of material reality? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
So what we started to sort of see and enable others to sort of experience is that we are basically a fourfold being. Now, I know that there are many spiritual models that sort of say we're many different levels of being, but
right.
primarily at a human level, we are four. We're made up of a material nature, which is
mm-hmm.
our DNA and our history and our constitution and our physical body.
Mm-hmm.
Then this needs to be animated, so we talk about this being a vegetative body, so we have an aspect of our being that allows us to come alive, to have our physiology function for us, to feel, to emote, to sense, to be nourished, to be nurtured, to be indeed sick, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, we have a body that we might call an animal body. Now, this is the body that mm-hmm. animates us, moves us, makes us get up out of a chair, wiggle our hips, be beautiful, look into the mirror, be egotistical. It gives
mm-hmm.
us our character, and it's our instinct to make love and actually, unfortunately, also to make war. And
mm-hmm.
then there's a human element in us. So we basically have a cognitive part, an instinctual part, a feeling part, and a historical part. So we're a four-level being. Well, we've...
Material, vegetable, animal, and human. Those
human,
are the...
Yes. Those
yeah,
are
okay.
four elements. And then
okay.
above that is a sort of noble element. In other words, a part of us that when we surrender, when we're in connection to a greater reality, to God, to Allah, to Yahweh, to Hashim, whatever
mm-hmm.
name we call the great life,
mm-hmm.
then actually this nobility in a way enfolds us and envelops us and
mm-hmm.
comes to us rather than us going to it. So we
mm-hmm.
have this potential fifth level that envelops us and gives us our noble level of self. And what
right.
you
isn't that
do,
where we that's where we all want to be
that's,
ultimately.
That's where we all want to be. And what
yeah.
we've recognized is that for most of us we are dealing in our history, in our DNA and our constitution, or we're dealing with sort of old feelings and, being wounded and being hurt and being separated from our mums and dads and things like that,
right.
or that we're sort of hung up in our, our egotistical personality, character, where we're sort of sexual beings, we're doing our life, we're running our life, where we're, trying to be number one, the best in the pack, we smoke.
That's the animal, yes.
That's the
yes.
animal. And then the fourth one is that we, enjoy our intellect, enjoy our ability to think, and we, think we're very clever, and we talk about spiritual matters, and we backbite or we do inappropriate things, once we've talked about these high and mighty things. So we've really concentrated on dealing with these sort of fundamental four-leveled creature that is called human. And giving them a vehicle to understand the process of emergence, which is this internal caduceus. I mean, the caduceus just happens to be the icon that we used.
Mm.
And that this enables them to grow and develop as really noble creatures. And that when you're connected to all your parts, and when all your parts are alive, and when you're really in the light, which is these three elements of the caduceus, then you're in a place which we call surrender. And so in our modeling, we've placed a dove above the eagle. And the dove...
The dove is really... Sorry, finish that thought.
The dove represents surrender. So it's the idea that the Holy Spirit... or whatever we want to call it, whether we call it in Judaic terms the Ruach Kodesh or Ruach Alofi or Ruach Kudus, depending on which language system you use, the Holy Spirit can come and succor us, take us forwards, envelop us, guide us, give us vision, give us, an inner understanding when actually normally we only have an intellectual understanding. So we place that fourth element above
mm-hmm.
the human.
So I wanted to just see if I got what you're saying, because we
uh-huh.
have to have these three parts of ourselves come connect, the connection, the alive, the self-reflection, and that, and then we kind of, if I'm right, overcome those four stages of the material, the vegetable, the animal, and the human,
uh-huh.
and we reach the place of nobility, which is the Holy Spirit, which is a place of surrender, and a place where the Holy Spirit embodies
Yes. By and large, that's more or less as it is. I mean, you know, obviously there are lots of philosophical arguments and ideas all surrounding that. But if we can sort of see ourselves as fighting what we might call the jihad against, you know, our different aspects, so that these different four levels become our supporting qualities rather than things that, you know, get in the way, then they support us as noble creatures. And that's the sort of key that really we've seen. So we started this idea of, you know, people coming in to see me as a practitioner, and that they were sick. And what we started to realize is that as people embodied these qualities of integrity, flexibility, reflectiveness, and surrender, that actually their health emerged, that their health came out of themselves, so that they grew bigger than their DNA, that they came up from their bad feelings and old feelings and hurt feelings, that they emerged out of old habits and sexual patterns that aren't so good, and things of you know, backbiting and being the best or, you know, biggest beast or whatever. And so they emerged, and as they emerged, their health got better. And so this emergence of health is really what we're looking at. And it's not just, you know, healthy body. It's healthy mind, healthy action, healthy feelings, et cetera, et cetera.
But you've just clarified something for me, in the sense that this nobility, this transcendence of our base nature, brings the nobility, which brings health.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the two are connected.
Absolutely intertwined. They really cannot be separated. So it's very easy to think that, you know, if we do all these, you know, sort of go to see people and get treated and helped, etc., that we can get our health better. But in reality, we need to have an inner life as well as an outer life, and the two should be together, should be parallel. And that's really what brings a proper health. Now, it could be that in that proper health you get sick. And that's
why
the paradox,
that? You know. But why would you get sick if you were healthy?
Ah, good question. Because sometimes the sickness is the gift that you need to move into the next place, the next emergence. So we're a sort of open system rather than a closed system. So we're always emerging. And sometimes we have to metaphorically break a leg or, you know, get a series of headaches or have difficulty with our wives or husbands so that we face the next wall or the next brick or the next piece of the puzzle that we have to unfold.
Because we wouldn't do it willingly? I mean, is there an easier way of getting this?
Well, my feeling is that in America, and you'll forgive me, Americans.
Sure, no,
I am really American. I mean, I'm American and British, but we live in a McDonald's era, you know, where we can go and get fed very quickly. We can go there and 5 minutes later we can stuff our faces with chips or fries, I think it's called. And
right.
And so in a way we've done the same with spirituality. We go and do, you know, some sort of training, and after four trainings we you know, call ourselves a master of something, you know.
Right.
And that actually can't be ever so. I mean, if we really look back into sort of historical times where you see these marvelous luminaries who had extraordinarily difficult lives, where they've been challenged every corner, and they've grown because they've struggled, because they've fought, because they've you know, confronted, because they've surrendered, because they've prayed, because they've done all of that hard work to move through the matter into the essence of the thing. And that's what we also have to do. There's no real easy roads. I mean, I'm sure people would like that, you know, and as I just said, we like to go to McDonald's, but it's not very ecological.
But isn't this where when the alchemical tradition, the great work, the disciplines, the inner development, which is constantly polishing those things that want to drag us back into the old world, this is where that comes in to create the nobility, right?
Absolutely. You have to do the work. And you know, I've written a sort of piece on our website called, about Aladdin, the little Iraqi, I think, the boy from Baghdad who goes down into a cave to find his old lamp.
Right. We're glad he's not there now, right?
I mean, what a beautiful city, what a tragedy. Anyway, Aladdin actually means excellence in religion. That's the sort of transliteration of the name. So it's an allegorical story about the little boy in all of us, whether male or female, so the sort of undeveloped male child in us, that goes down looking for something that he's lost by the promptings of his magician, which is the sort of animal dynamic of himself, his sort of ego self, his wisdom self, his innate wisdom knows that something he needs to find. So he goes down looking for this lamp. He has to go down those 49 steps, or anyway, the steps of his ancestors. And he comes across this old, dirty old thing that, you know, someone discarded 3, 4, 5, 10 generations back. He picks it up, and it's the lamp. And what happens, he goes back into the cave, you know, up from the sort of corridors or whatever, wherever he's been, and he picks from the floor all sorts of things in his pocket. He says, oh, that's, you know, a nice sparkly jewel. There's a nice golden plate. Gosh, I'm very poor. I better take all of this sort of gold and jewelry. And he becomes so heavy that he can't get out of the cave. Now, there is an example of depression. There is an example of someone who's locked up. There is someone who is unable to change. There's an example of someone who cannot get out of the dark. And that's many of us when we've picked up things of value that we think are useful from our ancestry. We carry them around with us, but we can never get out of the cave. So what does, you know, what does Aladdin do? He has a ring, and what he does is he twiddles the ring, and a genie comes out. And the gene, which is really the same thing as genetic and genius and genome, so the jinn, Arabic, it means concealed, is
that what genetics mean, concealed?
That's what I believe, the transliteration, if we take that, the etymological modeling of genius and genie and gene and genome, all have a similar... Yes, a similar sound, so it could be that I've, you know, twisted the modeling here. But in my understanding, in my experience, the jinn are sort of the activators of our genetic coding. And so what you see in Aladdin is the emergent impetus to rise up out of the clay. And that's what we all have to do. And the way he does it is to polish his vessel. And polish his vessel is really worship. And worship, you know, can be religion and can be spirituality, but my feeling is it's probably both. You know, that we need a discipline inside, which is really the alchemical process, and we need to follow a pathway so we don't get lost, and then we go into an inner life, which is the real depth of the religious or spiritual modeling that religions have, and that gives us the impetus to do the inner work that we need.
And then nobility will emerge out of this constant polishing. I guess it's our natural state for it to come out.
I think our natural state is constantly... Well, we need to polish because I think there's an awful lot of detritus on the lamp, you know, that we've got many, many generations of forgetfulness. And, you know, in Islam, the idea of dhikr, the word dhikr means to remember God, to remember Allah. And that's really what we have to do. And so religion was a good way, you know, for many hundreds of years to remember, to really remember where we are, who we are. In the trainings that I give to people, what we do is when we start to have a dialogue with another human being, we take a moment of surrender to God. In other words, we create a field of worship, a common sort of dynamic with a client, so that actually we start our process in remembrance.
And this is the remembrance of our basic spirit essence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
so what you're doing, though, when you work with people is, would you say, help accelerate their process and give them, you're not really giving them tools because there's, I mean, they're doing it, you're doing it for them in a way, because it's a discipline sort of comes from within. So this is, well, how do you reconcile, like, you're doing this for somebody, and then also their own polishing?
Yes, I think that's a very, very fair comment. There are two paths that we've created in our work. One is, if you like, a sort of practitioner of inner dialogue, which is a one-to-one or one-to-a-group process. So you're quite right. It's sort of one person dialoguing with others. The other process is that we've developed a system which is using this modeling of emergence and what we might call constellations, where we introduce the sort of learning and educational tool of the caduceus, of surrender, of understanding our natures, of experiencing our different aspects. And we enable people in that way to be educated about who they are and what they are, and therefore they can take that away into their ordinary lives, which enables them to polish their vessel. So there are two ways. One is that they have to do it on their own, and the other is that sometimes we need a companion, like us, to dialogue with the individual to get a very deep understanding of what they need at that moment.
So this is also an aspect of the work, is you're dialoguing with their person's body that reveals parts of the that they're not even conscious of. That's really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'll actually, as I'm talking, I'll give you a good example. This happens to be, it was actually done in Russia, so, you know, obviously no names, but it was a particular person who was extraordinarily bright and head of a particular department of psychology. And so I'm working with this person, and I'm putting these modes, hand modes, into her hand. And
Before you work with it, can you just go through the process of working with someone, like to get, before you get to the hand mode? So,
very good. Yeah. Yes, that's a good way to start. Yeah. Yes. So they would come in and sort of talk to us, obviously, first, and sort of say, this is, you know, what's going on, or this is what I would like to sort of understand, or this is,
You mean they'd have a physical problem or an emotional problem? It doesn't matter.
They have all sorts of problems. I mean, sometimes they come in just because they want to, you know, they've heard about us, but basically they can come in with any type of what we might call displays. Or they might come in with a shopping list of displays, you know, I've got this and this and this and that. And so we listen, obviously, because that's our job. And then what we sort of say is let's stand up, and we're going to take a moment of surrender right at the beginning of this process. But before we do that, we're just going to muscle test you, just sort of give us an indication of what your body is doing at the moment. So muscle testing, first of all, is highly inaccurate. It's one of the most inaccurate systems.
Well, I was going to mention that, but I figured you were a kinesiologist, and
no,
some people get offended.
You can say it to me. It is a very, very inaccurate system.
Because you could be thinking something and affect the outcome.
Absolutely. So we have built all of this sort of understanding of its inaccuracy into a model that creates an accuracy that is really unparalleled. In other words, we built a system that in a way reviews the idiosyncrasies of muscle testing as feedback. And so because the muscle testing, i.e. a muscle, can be switched off what we might call locally at the muscle itself, in the cord, so spinal cord, in the hindbrain, in the midbrain, in the animal brain, and in the human brain. And not only that, you yourself can influence the muscle testing, just as you've said.
Right.
And we've used all of that understanding and built a system that enables us to make it pretty extraordinarily accurate with all its idiosyncrasies. So without going into that, because that's, complex.
It's very complex. But so you have checks and balances, you're saying,
absolutely,
to make sure. I get it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because it's inaccurate, we have to make it, you know, sort of congruent as much as we can. And so that's what the mudras themselves really enable the process to occur.
Did you work out yourself this kind of checks and balances?
Yes.
Did you get that?
Yes, I did.
That's quite brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because I'm a sort of doubting Thomas, you know.
Yeah.
That there's a part of me that wondered how and why, and that doesn't look right. And I used to, actually, if I recall, I used to watch kinesiologists, you know, 35 years ago, and I'd say, gosh, he's cheating. He's muscle testing, and actually it's weak, and he's pretending it's strong, or, you know.
Yes, and it used to
really, you know, freak me out. And so in a way, I grew up with this sort of muscle testing is inaccurate, you know, why on earth are we doing it? And yet, I knew that there had to be some modeling that enabled us to get a real clarity, and that's what I've built into the system.
Okay, so go ahead, please.
Okay, so what we do is we get a what we call a baseline, so we sort of see where that person is. We take a moment of surrender, and after we've surrendered, very often the baseline has changed. In other words, their action of surrender has brought something into the picture. We don't necessarily know what it is at that moment, but something's happened. And so we use, so then we say, you know, did you feel something? Did you experience anything? You, the practitioner, might have, they might have, you use their, you know, their guidance, and you basically go from there. So the body, in a way, you're using as a computer, and you're metaphorically pressing, you're doing something with the body that presses the return button on the keyboard, if you like. Okay, so you add, you sort of load the system in, you load the information in. And so basically what we start to do is to get responses from the body using muscle testing that illustrate that the information is there, it's present, it's ready to be worked on, except that we don't necessarily know what it really infers or means.
So if you say, I have a problem with my girlfriend, you will test muscle, like what's the source of that problem?
No, we wouldn't ever do any of that.
Okay, then tell me.
You just get the person to stand up. We'd say, surrender, let go of all your ideas, and let's see what the great life really has in store for you. Then what happens is that we ask the person to acknowledge whether they're willing to be guided in this process, i.e. not by me, but by, you know, the creator, and are they willing to really be present or to be in their essence as I'm working with them? And that's sort of really an internal decision that they make, that they're willing to sort of, you know, start a process. So something's occurred, even though they said, yes, it's to do with my girlfriend, to do with my boyfriend, to do with my mother, it's my backache, you know, whatever it is, we started a process. We put them on the table, or we sit them on a chair, or we stand up in front of them. It doesn't really matter how we do this process. And we start to use muscles, they're muscle testing, using mudras, i.e. putting these hand positions into one of their hands. Each mudra has a particular sort of, if you like, question associated with it. And so we go through a protocol, initial protocol, to sort of, if you like, size up and tighten the model, make sure everything is working, and then we start to ask questions.
What kind of questions? Yes.
Well, the mudras would be asking questions like, now you're asking me a sort of funny question. We would start to ask questions like, what's the source of this? So, in other words, you did actually say, what was the source? So you'd say, is this ancestral? Is this mother, father's lineage? Is this in your physical body? Is this in your emotional body? Is this in your instinctual body? So we're asking questions about where is this held? Where's the dysfunction or the resource or the thing they need to find in themselves? Or is there something missing that they need? So there's a whole gamut, whole spectrum of information that we can ask. And what we're really doing is we're creating a story. We're saying we're starting at A, and we want to get to B, and B is the end of the story. And in between there are all the facets that have created your situation at this moment. So, yes, you're having
trouble. And it's all held in the body, which is quite amazing.
All held in the body. I mean, some of it is metaphorically sometimes outside. We can be affected by external things, and that this work encompasses those. But external elements, like, you know, collective consciousnesses and archetypes, etc., that exist outside of us, also mirror aspects within our own body. So,
That's fascinating, though, isn't it? That the body never lies. That it's a representation of. Of not just you, but all time in some sense.
Absolutely. I was going to sort of take take you up on that word, never lies. In fact, the body lies constantly.
Okay, please. Tell me.
Yes, it lies constantly, but it's okay for it to lie because it's a survival mechanism. And our job is, in fact, to notice the times when we don't say the truth, because actually that leads us more and more ultimately to, in fact, the root of the problem, the ontological dynamic that's really going on with the body. But the body's constantly making adaptations. So if we go to the material aspect of us, the body basically switches on and off. It's like a binary system, so on, off. So you can shut the lights metaphorically and not see something all the time. I mean, the body's doing that really all the time. Then,
but yet it remembers you're finding the truth when you go back.
Well, we are, but we have to. But we, in a way, almost have to be slightly, what's the word, like a detective. I train my practitioners to be absolutely able to notice every nuance of what's going on with that person every moment of the time, to be aware of the feelings and the sensations in their body and in the patient's body, to be attentive of the forces in the body or the forces in the room that get pulled up as people engage and face, you know, their beliefs and their monsters and their demons and et cetera, et cetera. So the training that we develop is very high-powered because we're teaching people to be absolutely cognitive of all the different unseen elements going on inside a body and around us all the time.
So then, okay, so then let's say you find the source of this person's discomfort, like whatever it is, psychological, ancestral, then how do you shift that for them?
Again, a good question. Well, you know, a lot of people have different licenses, so they come in with the ability to do hands-on work, or they have the ability to put needles in, or if they're an acupuncturist or if they're a doctor, they have a bigger sort of license. But actually what we do, we've got hand modes that, in fact, ask the body, well, what do you want? Not what I, the practitioner, want to do, but what does the body need at this moment to resolve the pattern? So these hand modes allow the body to say, well, actually, I would quite like to, you know, pray, or I'd like to have some homeopathy, or I'd like to have some massage or cranial work, or, you know, a myriad different number of things. It's the therapy is probably the least important part of this work. That's because the mudras themselves change the brain state. One of my colleagues, Konstantin Trifonov, is a physician from Moscow, and he's just finished his PhD. And what he found using this work was that severely psychiatric sort of people with what's called alexithymia, they were able to change these people's states, where their brain waves, brain state changed completely from the beginning of one series of therapy to the next, that these people who were normally unable to acknowledge how they feel and how they sense, 80% of them were able to then articulate how they felt and how they were and how they were feeling, which is almost unheard of in psychiatry. So this work absolutely changes the being of people and also the physiology and the psychology of people. And it's the mudras and the dialogue that does it, not the therapy.
And you develop this. It's a technology, really, is what you're telling me.
Absolutely. And there are many other people doing, you know, similar work. I can't say that, you know, this is unique to me. I think what's unique to us and this work is its absolute, that we really have put a sort of a really strong spiritual element into the working or the using of this work in that I train my practitioners to have this absolute feeling of being a companion and not a therapist. So we teach people not to do things to others, but to be present. And it's their presence that also enables change to occur.
But in order for that presence to happen, they have to embody nobility.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how do you train your practitioners to do that?
It's called a jolly long time. But I'm being naughty, but I'm also being serious. It takes time. It takes perseverance. It takes humbleness. It takes the qualities of a noble creature, which means that we have to fight our pride and yet have pride. We have to fight our greed, but nevertheless be greedy. We have to fight our ambition, but nevertheless be the best. We have to fight our knowledge acquisition and yet have cognition and understanding. And we have to fight our spiritual knowledge and yet have an understanding and an inner understanding of the spiritual.
Well, this is the duality of being a human being.
We have
to walk the line, fine line. So we have another probably 10 minutes, so I just wanted to kind of get the scope of the treatment. I may have had sessions, but I want to know more, in a sense, where the work is going and how you see a planetary unfoldment as you kind of see the evolution of individuals as a collective.
Gosh, that's a big question.
All right.
So the way I see that the work, or this sort of modeling, is that we are, first of all, teaching a whole new generation of people of how to truly dialogue with another human being. That's number one. So it allows us to really go into what David Bohm would have been talking about, which is the transaction of dialogue allows a logos, a knowing, actually wisdom, to come into each one of us.
So that's a dialogue using this kinesiology testing or something
Simply using the modeling of dialogue, whether you're using kinesiology or mudras doesn't really matter. What matters is that as I teach these people to do this work, in a way the work becomes secondary, because actually their ability to dialogue is the human process, not the action of, you know, pulling arms and putting mudras in. So they're learning how to be people who can truly be present with another, which enables others to change. So we're developing, helping people to develop as a really noble creature. And the work actually is interesting, because we're about to just go off to Russia to start to create a school of this work.
Right, Moscow. You're leaving Oregon, you're picking up, you're moving your whole operation to Russia.
Yes, we are. Well, we're not really leaving the whole operation, because we're putting into key positions people who have been trained to begin to do this work and to teach this work. We've got quite a lot of practitioners around the country, obviously quite a few here, because this has been our home base, also in Austria and England and, of course, in Russia and in different parts of the world. So we've got people who are teaching this work and who are able to teach this work. So we're not dropping it and running. We're sort of trying to hold this space as we move into another, if you like, emergence of us. And as I said, I've been offered the opportunity to start, do the primary research and the curriculum development of a school in Moscow of this approach.
Mm-hmm.
So this is so,
no, that's exciting, because it's a whole new phase for you. Because
it is indeed.
And what about your personal development? I mean, how do you get refined and more and more nobilized?
trial and error. No, I follow a spiritual path called Subud, which has been my path for about 40 years, nearly 40 years. Mm. It's a path of personal surrender, where I surrender to God, and I'm enabled to receive directly from the great life. And that, in a way, nourishes and turns me and scrapes me and polishes me and makes me get on my knees and learn how to be humble and break my pride et cetera, et cetera. So that's what's been our sort of main nourishment throughout our lives. And I've been a Muslim for 35 years, albeit a Scottish Muslim. I lived in Kuwait for 20 years. I lived in Afghanistan for nearly two. So I've had a very, you know, an upbringing which was very close to Islamic thought and feeling and the sort of field of Islamic thought. And it's penetrated and permeated and really been part of my life ever since. And I would truly say that that's been my single most influential aspect of my life, where I, you know, my whole life is about Islam, which means to surrender.
Right. People, Islam's gotten such a bad rap lately, and it's really a beautiful process of surrendering to this noble essence that we...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's just because we're scared of the other, really. And and Islam has a very strong message, and unfortunately there's an awful lot of disenfranchised Muslims out there because of our hegemony, and they're angry and pissed, and... So we see the bad rather than the good. You know, that's
but no, I get that. But don't you transcend when you really reach this high peak of humanity? Don't you transcend religion?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we really transcend religion, because the religion stays within you. What you do is that you see that all religion is really from the source. And,
right.
And therefore, that's the transcendent. So, you know, if I go back 35 years and see how nicky picky and horrible I was if I pointed a finger at a particular religion because I thought mine was better, I think, good God, I was that person. And yet, you know, 30 years on, I can see the absolute glory of all of these different models that enable different peoples of different color, of different psyches, to learn how to surrender to the great life in their different modes, and it's fantastic.
So do you see an evolution for the collective happening?
Absolutely, absolutely.
What do you see? Tell me, yes.
Well, I think we're all in an evolutionary process, and I think what's happening is that certainly in the present moment, where all of this sort of chaotic economic situation is occurring, is either a sort of fulcrum point for the change of this evolutionary process that we have to begin to develop. So either it's going to happen now, you know, in the next 10 years or so, or 20 years, or we're going to be in deep, deep trouble. And I think what has to happen is that we will find that in our economic and social lives, things are going to be very difficult. And when that happens, people turn inwards. And when they start to turn inwards, then they start to sort of take notice of what, you know, this is a living ecosystem. This is the world of us. You know, my body is the world and vice versa. And if I treat my body badly, you know, it's because I'm treating the world badly and vice versa. So we have to wake up. And this sort of moment in time, I think, is a epoch-making moment. And if it's global, i.e. it's going right through, you know, I mean, so many people are watching us here in America, you know, Barack Obama, who's turned up at this very extraordinary time. I mean, they're all looking to see that can we change? Can we alter our psyches? Can we alter our consumption? Can we alter our greed? Can we change from a material, you know, society to something that is more animated, more living, more culturally aware, more awake? And if we can do it, then the rest of the world will follow, which will be extraordinary.
What would you leave people with? What's the first, I mean, with not making a soundbite, but just what's the first thing that people should do or can do individually, collectively, to start to make a change in their inner being?
Yes. I think to embody the caduceus. In other words, to take that symbol and to metaphorically take it inside themselves. Instead of having it on a business card or to see it on the back of an ambulance or in a chiropractor's office, to take that symbol and literally place it metaphorically inside them and say, I am going to live a life that is upright, true, honest, grounded, and yet head to heaven. I'm going to live a life that is wide, expansive, fluid, feminine, transformative. And I am going to be a light to the world and be seen. How's that?
That is beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I got a lot from this. So your website is adhumanitas, A-D-H-U-M-A-N-I-T-A-S.com.
Very good, yes.
And,
yes, it is.
And anything else you'd like people to know about?
No. The website, actually, you've caught me slightly unaware, because our website is slightly sort of caught in a limbo, because we're almost putting a new one up, and so it's slightly out of date. So my apologies for those people who go there, but actually you'll get as much information as you want on it, because in fact it's got a huge amount of information already written there. It's just that it's not upgraded unto, you know, to today's date, that's all.
All right. But, yeah, so we'll have people go there and then...
And they can contact us, and we've got a book, actually, called Being Human. And if they'd like to get hold of that, they can go up onto the website called beinghumanbook.com, and they can order it from there.
Mm. Thank you, Salaheen. Salaheen.
Yes, my pleasure, Alan. Very, very kind of you to have asked me to talk tonight.
Oh, you know, I really enjoyed it. I really learned a lot, and I got a lot for myself in this conversation. So,
great. Well, thank you.
Thank you. And I'll put this up on my archives on newrealities.com. Also, you can find it on bbsradio.com. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I was talking to Salaheen about his great ontological kinesiology, his inner work, his process of unfolding the greater human being. And if you have any questions, you can also email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you for listening tonight, and listen next week too. Thank you, and check out the website newrealities.com.